That's it. That's all I have.
Good afternoon. I'd like to open a House Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness. Today's date, Thursday, June 6th.
And I would like to open an informational meeting on earthquake and tsunami preparedness. Well, I guess no. I open up the Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness first.
And I will then open the informational meeting on earthquake and tsunami preparedness.
And I will also open an informational meeting on earthquake and tsunami preparedness. This is how people from Gresham work together.
It is true. We're in tandem, yes. So, and with that, we'll have opening remarks from the good senator. So, our chair.
Yes, I always like to start out giving portraits of women. These are portraits written by women combat veterans. And this one was written by Captain Beth Roller, U.S. Army. She says, "Deployment for me was an amazing experience. It was a privilege to be over there, to be doing what I was doing, especially supporting the war fighters, taking care of them, boosting their morale. It was peaceful. I mean, you don't want to think of Iraq as a peaceful place. We get so wrapped up in a lot of the little things here, but you're there to do your mission, and that's what you do. You do your mission, you make sure it's taken care of. There were quite a few scares. Being on the road, your heart just pounds the whole time you're out there. But it's an adrenaline pounding, and I look forward to convoy days to get out and actually stretch my legs, get off the FOB, and just get in there. So I really enjoyed my deployment experience. I honestly believe, and I've talked to a lot of people who feel this way, if it weren't for families back home and things like that, shoot, I would be deployed my entire Army career if I could, because it really gives you a sense of meaning. It's like any job. You get in a rut, and every day I do the same thing, and I go to meeting after meeting after meeting. What am I really here for, and what's my real mission? Over there, you know, you're there to do one thing, and that's what you do. And it's really great having a purpose. And for a year in Iraq, you know what you're going to wear. There's no choices in wardrobe. You either wear this, or you wear a set of physical training uniforms and no civilian clothes. You go to the DFAC to eat, and you might have three main dishes to choose from. You eat what's there. It's good food. So when I come home, making decisions was hard. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you sharing the stories. I think that's a great tradition you've got going. Thank you. And with that, I will be stepping out for just the first few minutes momentarily, but we'll start with our first panel. And we have everybody broken into panels. Our committee administrators have done a great job of letting you know your timeline. Our first panel will have just maybe just a little over that, if we could. And I know that we have from Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission, Mr. Kent Yu and Jay Wilson, and we have one more joining today. So is Kent Yu here? Yes, sir. And Jay Wilson?
Stan Waters.
Okay. And Jay Wilson?
Bruce Johnson.
Well, we've changed it up a little bit. Well, we'll go with who's here. How about that? Okay. So thank you, gentlemen. And whatever order you like would be appreciated. And I appreciate that. And with that, I will step out for just a few moments. But thanks for being here today and look forward to the presentation. Thank you. Mr. Chair, how are you?
Right.
My name is Kent Yu. I'm the current chair of Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission. I want to thank the committee. Chairman Boquist, Chairman Matthews, and the members of the committee for inviting us back to provide you with additional information on the Oregon Resilience Plan. So before we start, I'd like to start off with my personal life. And as a consumer, my wife and I enjoy shopping on the weekends. We go to Costco, we go to Freddie Meyer, we buy grocery, we buy Tillamook cheese, we buy Oregon wine, and we also buy appliances made elsewhere. Sometimes we buy off-season fruits growing in Mexico or Chile from Costco. And, you know, in the night, sometimes I take my kids to watch a movie. In the summertime, and we take our kids to the beach to see Oregon's beautiful coast. I really love Newport. Sometimes I bring my crabbing pots with me and catch some crabs and make a nice meal out of them. So You know, on the weekdays, my wife take my kids to a bus stop, you know, so that they can go to school, and then they go to Intel, collaborating with colleagues in Texas, in Arizona, California, and other places, through a video conference, collaborating, designing state-of-the-art computer chips. Right. Then they pass along those computer design chips to the fab, and they can manufacture all these chips. Now they sell all the chips, you know, elsewhere around the world. So the point I want to make here is with all these activities, we're supported by the reliable infrastructure. We need a reliable infrastructure to make that happen. We need a liquid fuel. We need transportation, roads and bridges. We need ports to bring in fruits and clothing and shoes from elsewhere. And also we want to sell our computer chips and wines elsewhere as well. You know, you all agree that, you know, regardless your background, regardless your what you do, your career, and the without the infrastructure in place, our life will be affected deeply, not only at a professional level, but also at the personal level as well. Mm-hmm. Now, the off our coast, there's a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. You know, we did not recognize the effects of this earthquake until 1993. Most of the infrastructure buildings we're using today were built before that. Okay. So clearly this is a huge threat to our infrastructure, to our buildings. Now, if this earthquake happens, it's going to cause 2 to 4 minutes shaking, and also our coastline will drop 3 to 5 feet when the earthquake happens. Then within 15 to 25 minutes, the tsunami will come in. So this is going to cause huge damage on our infrastructure and also cause lots of concern on the people's safety living in the coast as well. You know, you guys are very concerned about it. You passed the Resolution 3 last year, asked us to prepare this Oregon Resilience Report. We recruited 169 volunteers. They donated millions of dollars worth of professional services to develop this document. We delivered that document back in February. In this document, we have a total of 8 chapters. We focus 5 chapters at the bottom in red. Those are the infrastructure underpinning our state's economy to support the business and our workforce in our state. We also have another chapter dedicated to our coastal community because they are facing a unique challenge, which is tsunami. Now, the Cascadia earthquake is a giant elephant in the room. You know, we haven't done a whole lot with it. We talked about it over the past 20 years, but we have done a whole lot with it. The progress is awfully slow. And on the Oregon Resilience Plan, we put a clock on the top of the state capitol building. Clock is ticking. And we came back, in March, give you a presentation. In March, also, we were invited to give a presentation to House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. From the communication we had, from what I see, we are here from you, I understand you are very worried about the grave consequences if we don't do anything about this earthquake. And also, we know you are also excited about the plan, because this plan provided the recommendations that could lead our state to a bright future. So that's why we're here today. You invited us back to give you additional information on our recommendations, chapter by chapter. So we break our report into 3 segments. And today we're going to talk about executive summary, followed by energy, and ended with the transportation. And in the next hearing, we're going to talk about business continuity, workforce. And we're going to talk about the coastal community as well as critical essential buildings. In the last hearing, we're going to come back to talk about the recommendation for telecommunication, water, wastewater, and then also we'll want to talk about additional research we need to better understand the earthquake and the tsunami caused by Cascadia earthquake. So, you know, the Oregon Resilience Plan, you know, what is resilience? I want to just quickly review that and also put this into perspective in terms of sustainability and also in terms of economic loss, okay? So the, in Oregon Resilience Plan, our definition on resilience is pretty much to save lives. And we would like to minimize damage so that we can have a rapid recovery from the damage so that we can protect our economy, preserve our community. After the event, we would like to see our systems built much better than before the earthquake. Okay. I want to use this graph to explain what it is. Essentially, is this is the bottom horizontal axis represents the timeline. Vertical line represented the level of services provided our buildings and infrastructures. So this is normal condition right now before the earthquake happens. When the disaster happens, bridge will collapse and pipeline will break. And so then our lifeline will suffer some damage and then we're going to lose some level of services. Okay. This is the top triangle representing the Chile and Japan. So they're going to drop a little bit and they're going to quickly bounce back. Once they fix their system with the new system, more reliable modern system, and so after the earthquake, their lifeline is much more reliable than what they used to have before the earthquake. Now, Oregon, we're not as prepared as Japan and Chile. We're gonna suffer a lot more damage. We're gonna drop all the way down to here, and we're gonna have a very slow recovery. There are several reasons for that. We're going to have faced magnitude 9.0 earthquake from the Cascades subduction. It's a major earthquake. It's a large earthquake. Second piece I want to talk about is that the lifeline interdependency. Lifeline, as I said, most of our infrastructure were built before. We recognized the effects of the Cascades subduction earthquake, so they were underdesigned. And also different lifelines, they're depending upon each other. For example, if you want to fix the water, you need to fix the electricity. You not fix the electricity, you need to fix the roads. You not fix the roads, you need to have communication, need to have fuel in place, all of that. Because none of those sectors are resilient, are prepared, so we cannot restore all these lifeline sectors simultaneously. So there's a sequence. So because of that, it's taken much longer for us to restore all these utilities in place. And the other piece I want to talk about is the very, very large the impact by this earthquake. You know, like California earthquake, typically they're very small, they're localized, they only affect a very small region. Cascadia earthquake will affect from Northern California all the way to BC Vancouver. And majority of the western part of Oregon will be affected. In California, they have small earthquake, they have the luxury getting support, material, personnel coming from neighboring towns and cities to help them out. In Oregon, we have nobody. We look to the south, California, the same ship, the same boat. And to they look to the north, you know, Washington, they are on the same boat as well. So the closest place we can get support is from Idaho, maybe from Redding, maybe Spokane. So because of the lack of the personnel, lack of the material supply, so it's all of that will take a long, long time to get us there. Now, when we have this damage here, we got to replace all these damaged parts. Okay, so this is what contributed to the direct economic loss. Now, from this point all the way to when we get ourselves out of the woods, when we fully recovered from the earthquake damage, well, this is a time called, we have this downtime, economic business downtime. This business downtime means that we have a huge economic loss due to the fact that we cannot produce, contribute to the economic activities. If we don't have water, Intel cannot make their computer chips. Without a building, without water, I cannot go back to my office to do consulting work. So all of that essentially will cause the secondary, so-called indirect economic loss. So combined together, we're facing very large economic loss. So last piece that I want to talk about, touch upon, is what's the relationship between the resilience and sustainability. You know, sustainability is a great thing to, as I previously mentioned to you, is that the sustainability is how can we reduce our human footprints on the environment. It means that we protect the environment, reduce energy usage, you know, so that we have a good environment for our children in the future. Resilience is different. We're talking about is environment. How can we minimize environment's impact on human environment, you know, human built environment. Environment through hurricane, flooding, earthquake, all kind of stuff, and that's going to damage our infrastructure. So how can we reduce that? All of that. So essentially, resiliency is the measure of our immunity system, our infrastructure. Now, they're different, but they're helping each other. We believe that resilience will enhance the sustainability. Think about this. If you build a building to minimum code standards in an earthquake, this building will damaged, heavily damaged, will be torn down after earthquake. And what if you build the building for more resilient state, much more resilient? After the earthquake, you will do only minor dam repair work. And you can put the building to use right afterwards. So essentially, yeah, you keep all the energy embodied in the building. So we see that the resilience will help sustainability. The other way you can look at it is your kitchen remodeling. Yeah. So you can, you know, when you fix your kitchen appliances, you want to save energy. But if you don't put your building down to the foundation, all the investment you made into your kitchen appliances will go away. So we see that they're different, but they are helping each other. So for this Oregon Resilience Plan, we divided our state into four zones. I want to mention that. So this red line represents the Cascadia subduction zone. And we divide our state into four areas. The red represents tsunami inundation zone. And also we have the coastal zone above the tsunami inundation. And we have a valley and the eastern central Oregon. For different zones, we're depending on each other. We have different objectives. For the tsunami inundation zone, our goal is to get the people out of the tsunami inundation zone to save lives. The property in the tsunami inundation are pretty much lost. Okay. For the coastal above a tsunami inundation zone, because of the long shaking, because of the geological formation, we believe the bridges and roads will be heavily damaged, and also we're going to see enormous landslide, which means the 101 won't be passable anymore. So we're going to isolate all these coastal communities. Now, this coastal community also has to provide shelter, food to the people displaced from the tsunami inundation. The valley, that's where the majority of the population is. That's where the majority of the economic activity is. So the goal over there is that we need to quickly restore the utility services so that we can go back to the normal, and we can resume our business economic activities, and we can preserve our communities over there. Eastern Central Oregon is pretty much the staging ground because the intensity is much lower, so we can rely on the Eastern Central Oregon provide support to the valley. From the valley, we can support the coastal communities. So on the lifeline, I briefly mentioned about interdependency, is that they're all interconnected. There's a chicken egg thing situation, but I want to just pick a few main things I talk about it. Interdependency is that, well, if we don't have water coming out of your faucet, what's going to happen? It means either you don't have electricity to pump the water, or it means that the pipeline somewhere is broken. So you need to fix the broken pipeline. In order to fix the broken pipeline, you need to fix the broken bridge first. Before you fix the bridge, you need to get a liquid fuel. Same thing for the electrical power system. You need to fix the bridge, and then you can fix the power system. So they are all interconnected, depending upon each other. Another thing I want to talk about is the co-location. What is the co-location? I want to just use this national map. This is a broadband system across our nation. These dark line represents these cables, you know, all of that. So I want to show you, if you look at it closely, what are they? What are these cable lines? What are they following? This is I-5. This is Highway 15. This is Highway 80. You know, all these roads are essentially our major lifelines, tend to follow the roads. If we zoom in a little bit around Portland, what are they? We have lots of bridges around, you know, in Portland area. When these lifelines cross over bridges and canyons, they are typically supported by the bridges. This is a map developed by USGS. You can see we have different color represents different lifelines. And I work with Bruce Johnson. He identified a number of bridges that are supporting all the lifelines, other lifelines other than the bridge itself. Okay. You can see what it is. So which means if we lose one of the bridges, means we're going to lose the lifeline system the bridge is currently supporting. So with all of these things, we have to consider that we need to really take a holistic approach to look at this whole resilience situation in our state. After a year of study, we have, you know, you've seen this before. I just want to quickly go over that with you. As of today, if OSPI happens tomorrow, we're going to have suffer significant economic loss. We are talking about minimum 20% state of GDP. We are talking about tens of thousands of people who have perished from the earthquake shaking and the tsunami inundation. Another piece is that we have a liquid fuel situation, and Stan will talk about that when he discussed his findings on the for the energy sector. And we work with business group. We understand that they are saying they can only tolerate 2 to 4 weeks of business disruption. Means they can only tolerate 2 to 4 weeks of utility service disruption. Okay. Now, Our state is the, our state is small state business. So small business state. Essentially, what does that mean is that we have roughly about 60% of workforces are hired by small businesses. So if the disruption goes beyond 4 weeks, what's going to happen to those businesses? They can they get closed or they are relocated, move to somewhere else, possibly even the state. Now, that happens means we're going to lose our job opportunities. People will leave as well. Now, I want to show you a few examples of the resilience gap. Electricity in the valley, we are talking 1 to 3 months. In the valley, we're talking about, for the water, we talk about 1 month up to a year. The bridges, we're talking about 6 to 12 months. We didn't show the telecommunication. Telecommunication is, it's in the same boat. It's also somewhere around six months to 12 months. Because telecommunication, they have 21st century equipment, they're sitting in 1940 vintage building. These buildings unlikely will survive the earthquake. So folks will ask, well, can we achieve resilience for magnitude 9.0 earthquake? The answer is yes, yes, yes. This is from my personal experience. And the Chile, I went to Chile in 2010. I also went to Chile, went to Japan in 2011. 2 weeks after the earthquake in Chile, I was able to drive around from place to place looking for earthquake damage. Within 2 weeks, they are able to restore 90% of communication. And they are able to resume their commercial flight after 10 days. 95% of power supply were restored within 2 weeks. They have a little bit of challenge with the water. They have to ration the water supply. So when I was leaving a hotel, I have to watch, you know, when I can take shower, etc. But other than that, they're pretty resilient. Japan is the same. You know, other than tsunami inundation zone, when I was in Japan 3 months after earthquake, this is the picture we were taking out in Sendai train station, looking from inside out. You know, we didn't see the sign of damage, and we didn't. If you say, well, if you don't know, this area has already gone through a 9.0 earthquake, you would have never guessed that this region has gone through a 9.0 earthquake. You know, other than tsunami inundation, that's a different story. So we develop overarching recommendations. We want to touch upon those high-level recommendations. You can hear all the detailed recommendations from different chapters later on. We believe the lifeline is they're interdependent, and they tend to co-locate together. And we believe that we need to have a quarterback. Essentially, is to coordinate all the efforts. We need to have this. We believe we strongly recommend we have a resilience office to lead, to coordinate, to plan, and to provide support for all the activities we need to have to make our state resilient. Second piece is that we need to take a comprehensive assessment of all the lifeline systems, critical buildings that currently supporting our state's economy. And then also we need to start to look at investment. How can we, in order to reduce the economic loss and quickly put our economy back and protect our community, we believe we need to start to do a couple of things. Number one thing, we need a sustained investment on the public-owned structures. I think the state, the city and the county need to take leadership and to tell the citizen and the rest of the state that the seismic resilience is a really serious problem we've got to deal with. And also, we need to provide appropriate incentive to the private sectors, giving them an incentive to advance the resilience. When they build their systems, when they build their buildings, they should build, we encourage them to build their systems more resilient than what the code required. Our code tells you is minimum requirement. It's a threshold. We want to encourage them to build higher than that so that with the resilience in mind, we need to have the capacity in place after earthquake for response and for recovery. Last piece, we need to update our public policies, that including the 72-hour old standard. We need to change that. We need to change that standard to 2 weeks of preparation at least. And also, we need to simplify the permitting process so that we can have a rapid response and a recovery. Last piece I want to talk about is looking ahead. you know, because of time limitation, we cannot address all these issues. We believe that since Washington shared Columbia River with us, you know, power grids and liquid fuel and all of that with us, we believe we need to have a joint planning with Washington State to address those problems together. And also, we believe that it's important to take the statewide resilience planning, because we divide our state into four zones. We need to take the same methodology down to community level, city level, county level, to look at each city, each county, to look at how many days they have to wait to receive the major relief supply, how many days they have to receive they have to wait in order to get the utility service restored, right? And typically after earthquake, you know, first couple of days, you won't get organized support from the government. It typically is everybody, the community is on their own. So normally what I see, based on what I saw in other countries like Chile, like Peru, is that faith-based organization, they tend to take the leadership, provide the support for the local community. Then you know, 5 days later, typically is the government support will show up. They can take over from that moment. So in order to make our society truly resilient, we need to look at the civic infrastructure, these faith-based organization, make sure they're resilient. And also we want to continue to educate our citizens, make sure they're prepared at a personal level so that in the end we can be all resilient as a state. This is a huge problem, as I always, you know, we said last time, is this is a huge problem. You may be overwhelmed by the size of the problem, but the problem is this: if you have a vision in your mind, if you know your vision in 50 years, you know what? Slowly but surely, you can get there. And as long as you stick to that direction, stick to that vision, and you're going to get there. So we use that, you know, one bite at a time. Try from Portland to Eugene, you know. Yes, could be long distance. However, if you know where's the milestone, you follow your milestone rigorously, eventually you're going to get to Eugene. That concludes my talk.
And it might be a good idea, since there's so much information, if the committee would like to ask questions as we continue through the panel. Does anybody have any questions at this point? Yes.
So you had a slide that talked about the power lines and the phone lines being back up in 10 days in Japan. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious what their setup is like, because I've heard in other presentations that, you know, we could be weeks and long periods of time with getting power, some kind of in phone. And so I'm curious if, you know, are their phones, are their lines landlines? Are they above ground? Are they just cell towers? I know, like, you know, a lot of the developing countries don't have the kind of archaic phone lines and things that we built, you know, 60 years ago in this country, and their cell towers. So if you could drop a cell tower back up pretty quickly, your phone service, I would assume, would go back up. So can you share how they did that as quickly as they did?
Yes. Well, first of all, you know, for on the power side, based on what I read, I believe that their main transmission line, main, you know, high voltage transmission line, more or less remain intact, and also they have high redundancy. So even if one or two transmission line went out of business, but because their redundancy, they can go, instead of going there, they can go, because the power line tend to go like a circuit, so they can, if this way is gone, then we can go that way. So essentially, they have this redundancy place. The other thing is also, they have gone through so many earthquakes, and their system is inherent, is more resilient than what we have in our system. And on the telecommunication, it's the same story. Their buildings are more resilient than our central office. Central office, essentially, these are critical nodes. When you make a phone call, they send you to the central office. From the central office, they're going to switch, send you to different directions. So their central office tend to be more resilient, more modern than we have. If you go to around, if you just look at our state, these central office tend to be very old, you know, 1930s, 40s. The reason, the other thing is these buildings are not easily relocatable. The reason is this, you know, on the surface, all we see these buildings. But if you zoom in, we have all these underground cable coming from all different directions, comes back up, and then it could go down again, go to another node. So these buildings cannot be easily movable. If we move this building, we're going to move all these cable with it. So it's, and so that's the situation we're dealing with. We're dealing with very old buildings. And so in Japan, they have you know, much better central office, more resilient structures. And the other thing is also they have they use this, you know, rapid approach, like what you're saying, using what is called the cell on wheels, cal system. So, you know, they with a combination of all these things, you know, resilient, inherently resilient structure plus other means. So they, you know, they're better prepared. That's why.
Thank you. Any other questions? Continue.
All right. Commissioner or Chairs Borquist, Matthews, and members of the committees, thank you for the opportunity to present the energy sector recommendations of the Oregon Resilience Plan. I am Stan Waters, and I am an OSPAC commissioner and one of the co-chairs of the Energy Section Subcommittee of the Oregon Resilience Plan. So basically, Kent has already talked about our group looked at the four regions. They each have their own risks when it comes to the energy sector and the infrastructure in those areas. And needless to say, as Kent said, we are going to see a catastrophic situation in most of those zones except for Eastern Oregon. This graph here just kind of shows some of the vulnerabilities and how long it would take to recover. And this is really highly dependent on many factors, which we've talked about, which are the other lifelines that restoration is going to rely on, such as transportation, communications, water, things of that nature, and mainly liquid fuels. So,
I can't read.
We're old up here, so we can't see these.
I even have glasses, and I couldn't.
The red line there. What is the red line?
The red line is the non-tsunami zone in the coastal region.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry. So, some of the main risks that we identified in the energy subcommittee was the liquid fuel situation in the state. In the graph up in the or the map up here in this corner, this is basically highlighting our liquid fuel delivery systems into the state of Oregon. We have pipelines that mainly come out of Washington from the refineries, come into Northwest Portland industrial area, and are stored in bulk fuel tank farms. We also receive fuel via barges on the Columbia River and then into the Willamette. This area is highly susceptible in Northwest Portland to liquefaction and lateral spreading. It's all built on dredge material from way back when. We have pipelines through that area, as well as I've indicated, marine vessels are the two delivery systems into that. From that area on down into Eugene, there's another pipe that then for fuel storage down there as well, but they are also in the valley and susceptible to the same risks we have in the Portland area. The storage of these fuels, as I've indicated, are in bulk tank farms here along the Willamette River and also the Northwest Industrial Area. As I've indicated, some of the risks here are the delivery of fuel by barge. So the shipping channel on the Columbia River is highly susceptible to damage in this earthquake and will limit the, it'll impact the draft depths of the vessels will be able to pass and would impede ship traffic to our storage facilities, even if they are still existing. Also, our marine terminals are highly susceptible. They most likely will not survive, so for them to be able to even accept vessels for delivery of fuel will be interrupted. And then one of the other key areas that we looked at was, you know, not only the overall fuel supply, but there is a pipe that takes fuel directly for jet fuel out to Portland International Airport, which is another key transportation resource as far as during a recovery period. So most likely that pipeline will also be extremely damaged. Some of the other identified risks in the energy sector, we looked at natural gas. The bulk of our natural gas comes out of Canada, and it comes right down the I-5 corridor, as Kent indicated. It also comes from the east, both on Williams Pipeline system, and then one that's kind of hard there to read is the Trans-Canada Pipeline that comes into Oregon, and that is mainly serving the needs of California. So really, we're highly reliant on the Williams Pipeline system. Some of the, on the power side, we are in an integrated, interconnected system in the western United States. Most likely, we will lose the western grid. Major interties will be lost. We have major interties with California down here, 500 kV systems, also up into Canada. Most of those interties will be lost. One of the key things in the power industry that really needs to be looked at in the vulnerability assessments that we have recommended is that some of these critical infrastructure, like major switching equipment and large transformers, have 18-month lead times. So if they are damaged, trying to get this type of equipment here and back in place could take a considerable amount of time. We also looked at the critical energy hub here in the northwest industrial area of Portland. We have three major 230 kV lines crossing the river here, major substations, two of those in the area. LNG is located here, and then, of course, the tank farm. So quite a bit of eggs all in one basket right in northwest Portland. Kent talked about the interdependencies and how this relates to the energy sector. Is to restore energy service, we do need the roads. To open the roads, we need to restore fuel. To restore fuel, we need to pump it out of the ground, which requires electricity. And to restore water service, you also need electricity. So we're our ability to respond is very dependent on many of the other lifeline sectors. So we try to do our best realistic assessment. We obviously looked at Japan and Chile and what was going there. Ken had already mentioned about all the activities that they've taken early on to make themselves resilient and how quick they were able to respond. Some of the examples here is this is a transformer that failed, obviously not anchored properly. In many cases, our major transformers here are not currently anchored. The utilities are currently, as they go into their facilities, are starting to anchor them, but they're not all anchored at this point. But basically, you know, these seismic events and what we learned really, you know, led to HR3 and the resilience plan. So we looked at all these things as we evaluated our own risks. Impacts to Oregon. The seismic risks exist in our critical energy infrastructure. These are critically important energy structures, and they're susceptible to significant damage with catastrophic consequences. I've already talked about the liquid fuel, natural gas, transmission lines that will be susceptible. Storage will also be susceptible. And then the electric facilities, transmission and power equipment, significant failures. The waterway is also expected to be closed and require cleanup. So this critical piece of transportation infrastructure, in order to help deliver fuel to our state, will most likely not be available. Western Oregon, we will face an electrical blackout. We will have extended natural gas service outages. We will have a severe liquid fuel shortage and damage and losses in the tens of billions of dollars. So with all that as a backdrop, as far as the impacts and what we looked at, the energy sector recommendations, as Kent mentioned, we really need to have an entity responsible for coordinating all these efforts. We also, in working with the regulated utilities in the state, they had a strong desire not to have any further regulatory entity directing their activities, so they would like to have oversight for their seismic preparedness sit with the OPUC to deal with their preparedness, and this would include telephone, natural gas, and electricity that are those companies that are currently regulated by the OPUC. And one thing I should mention, we haven't mentioned a lot about it, and you're not going to hear from the telecommunications subcommittee until the last hearing, but what you see here in a lot of our recommendations will look very consistent with what they're going to recommend as well. And both our subcommittee and the telecommunications subcommittees coordinated our efforts while we were doing our studies. One thing I should mention, developing new regulatory oversight for energy operators not regulated by the OPUC. We have a large sector of consumer-owned electric utilities that are not regulated by any entity. They are regulated by their own individual boards. And how we deal with that will be critically important for those people that get their service from those utilities. We also, just so you know, we have limited state regulation over pipelines and very limited regulation over liquid fuel and liquid fuel storage. So how do we engage those entities in order for them to deal with their own seismic resiliency is going to be critical. So we need to create some type of oversight in that regard. We are recommending that all energy operators conduct seismic vulnerability assessments of their critical energy infrastructure facilities and develop mitigation plans. Now, this is a plan, as you know, that we want to get resilient over a 50-year period. So the idea is do the assessments, put together the mitigation plans, and then have those mitigation plans monitored and tracked by the appropriate oversight authority. They need to institutionalize these long-term seismic mitigation programs and work with the appropriate oversight authority to improve their resilience and their operational reliability. One of the elements of any time an entity goes in and does a vulnerability study, they are susceptible to liability. And similar to the current vegetation management programs that are in utilities, the state should provide some type of immunity for this liability in statute for their seismic vulnerabilities that are identified within their seismic vulnerability assessments. We also believe that the state should provide statutory authority for prescriptive waivers of routine permitting requirements for design, construction and restoration of our energy infrastructure. I don't know if you recall, but when at the first hearing, the utilities got up and talked individually about the fact that they have mutual aid agreements, and our utilities in this state have responded many times to disasters across the United States, including recently Sandy over on the East Coast. They've traveled that far, and their problem in providing mutual assistance is how do they get their big rigs across state lines, and these are the type of permit waivers that need to happen, and many times they have to wait for those permits to happen before they can move their infrastructure into place to help aid communities that have experienced a disaster. So in many cases, we are suggesting that prescriptive waivers for these routine type permitting requirements be waived. We also believe that we need to form a public-private partnership to evaluate the diversification of locations of liquid fuel storage and new energy corridor. The state does need to partner with operators to address these specific risks. There is nothing currently in place that would suggest that the companies that provide liquid fuel to the state of Oregon are all of a sudden going to build a fuel tank farm on the east side of the Cascades so that we diversify where we store our fuel so that in case we do have a disaster, we have ample supplies to deal with the shortages that we're going to experience. And so somehow we need to be able to create that partnership with these entities and work together to diversify the location of our liquid fuels, and then also to deal with new energy corridors that will be required to help diversify the supply of energy into our various parts of the state.
Question for you, President, or clarification, because I already know the answer. In the last two bullets there, it's correct that the closest access to liquid fuel pipelines for retail fuel versus crude fuel is actually the Pasco docks. Is that not correct?
I believe that's correct.
So that's 300 miles of road. Any fuel would have to, if you could get fuel from there, it would have to come down the east-west interstate system 300 miles by bulk fuel, and that I think most of the bulk fuel trucks are not equipped or even structured in such a manner that you could take the bulk fuel into retail fuel. Is that correct?
That's correct. All the refineries, the refineries that we receive all of our supplies from are out of Washington. I think the other closest refineries would be out of Salt Lake City. That we would need a truck in or rail, but rail is going to have the same issues as roads, so we are highly susceptible. The other area that we looked at was that we really want the state to require liquid fuel wholesale and retail operators to provide access to an alternate means to deliver fuels. This came out of some of our investigative work of some other disasters where fuel was in the ground in service stations, but they had no electricity and they had no alternate means to pump that fuel out of the ground. And so we're not being prescriptive as to what those options are or what those means are, but there should be a way to get fuel that is in the ground, out of the ground during the disaster. There was one example that was brought to my attention was a few years ago, the U.S. Coast Guard had to fly in a bladder of fuel over to Camp Rylea so that Pacific Corps would have fuel to restore coastal communities that were in a significant outage from one of the winter storms. So if there was just no way to get the fuel out of the ground that existed over there for them to run their trucks.
Oh, it's really bad.
Yeah.
I have the full report.
Okay.
Yeah, a couple of the other energy sector recommendations is we need to evaluate options for improving power supply to the coastal areas that are outside of the tsunami inundation zone. And some of the options that were talked about is, or for consideration, is that the moving of critical infrastructure like substations out of the inundation zone and to higher areas. Other concerns were there is really no generation on the east side or the west side of the coastal range, and so all the generation, the power gets delivered from the valley. Those ties are going to be cut, and so how do we provide electricity to our communities on the coast? So some ideas that were expressed by the group, but we didn't get into specific options, is looking at some type of localized generation options for the coastal communities. And then our last recommendation deals with the public-private sector employee to ensure coordinated planning, information sharing, and interoperability among critical organizations and agencies. We really need to have a plan in place to address disaster recovery before and also after the event. So with that, I'd just like to say that we thank you for the opportunity to present the energy sector recommendations of the Oregon Resilience Plan. And in common with the other sections of the plan, increasing the resilience of our energy sector requires that we conduct new assessments of our infrastructure, make new capital investments to improve the performance of critical structures and systems, develop appropriate incentives to engage the private sector partners in the energy sector, and consider policy changes needed to fine-tune existing state policies. And I urge you to use, you know, these four overarching priority areas as a lens to focus your legislative decision-making as we begin to move towards steady resilience over the next 50 years. With that, Bruce? Oh, I should say, any questions?
Let's see if we have any for you, Mr. Waters. Okay. Just 1 second. Any questions?
It's more of a comment than a question, but I just wanted to let you know that we have started doing our part here in the building, and we passed House Bill 3448, which is mostly at the request of OHSU and OPB, who have emergency operations. And what we did was we dropped the requirement that they have a certain percentage of biodiesel in their fuel, so that they won't experience a gelling if it sits for a long time. And the university hospital can keep its generators running, and OPB, emergency broadcasting, can continue broadcasting emergency messages, assuming they have electricity. But
thank you for that. Anybody else have any questions? Thanks again. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Johnson, we have about 15 minutes or so, if you're able to do it within that kind of time frame.
Okay,
I'll try. Trying to keep everybody on schedule. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Chair Matthews, Chair Boquist, and members of the committees. Bruce Johnson, a state bridge engineer with Oregon DOT, and during the last year served as the chair of the transportation subgroup for the Oregon Resilience Plan. Starting out my presentation by showing you the Markham Bridge in downtown Portland, one of the first bridges ODOT did retrofit on for seismic resiliency. Also in the lower picture there, showing you a landslide situation, because during the Resilient Oregon Plan, we did expand the work that we were doing on vulnerability to include not only bridges, but landslides and unstable slopes and liquefaction. We had some really good help on the transportation subgroup from the ports, Coast Guard, a couple of our technical universities. We had five consultants who are very interested in the seismic area step up to help us, as well as the locals and several of the state agencies. We started out with some concepts, one of which was that we're convinced that retrofit is an excellent means of cost-effectively making our system more resilient. I'm talking about structural retrofits, strengthening of unstable slopes and slides, and in areas of liquefaction, ground treatment that can mitigate the effects of liquefaction. We also did our plan based on the fact that we know there's going to be long-term economic effects and loss of life, and we were trying to reduce the secondary loss of life. That is, those who are injured could be saved and helped if we could only reach them. We also recognize that strategic planning is critical, and we need to have an orderly, strategic way to approach increasing resiliency. Just showing you a picture of a bridge falling down to explain that we have talked about doing structural retrofits in a phased or sequential manner. The first phase we call life safety, which is just basically hooking things together so they won't fall apart. There would be significant damage under a phase one retrofit. You would not be able to use the bridge, but at least it wouldn't collapse. This is an example of phase two, which is more costly, 4 to 5 times more costly than the life safety retrofit. But it would avoid this kind of damage, and it would actually allow you to use the structure within, say, about 3 days after an event. We do have means of strengthening landslides and reducing their vulnerability. They're proven methods, and it's very feasible to do that. We do have, in Oregon, along the Coast Range, and along I-84, through the mountains on 58, very significant landslide and unstable slope situations that would be vulnerable to seismic motions. You saw this slide in Kent's presentation, the four zones. I wanted to point this out because I want to later explain our phased approach and why our initial investments are focused in the Central Oregon area. couple of reasons. It's very expensive to do everything all at once. We know we need a phased approach. Ground motions and damage is predicted to be light in Central Oregon, and so the cost to start retrofitting and making that system resilient is lower, and we can have greater bang for our buck. I want to go through the different modes that we looked at just to give you a sense for the vulnerabilities. And the first one I chose here is the railroads. You probably know we have two major trunk lines running north and south in Oregon. The BNSF is the easiest. It's right up near Highway 97. And then it comes in along 84. BNSF shares this line from the California border to Chemult with UP. There are some vulnerabilities in that area, but that line could be made resilient if those private railroads had some incentive to do that. There's a major landslide up in this area that would need to be addressed, and there are a few bridges in here. Along I-84, there's significant landslide risk and significant bridge risk. So I-84 would be very tough, expensive for a railroad to make it resilient. For the UP, the first area of difficulty is along the Oregon 58, and there's an enormous risk of landslide in that area. It would be very, very costly. Almost, it would be easier to relocate than to make that section resilient. Up the valley, there are some liquefaction issues. There's some older bridge issues. It's probably conceivable that it could be done, but then you wouldn't have any connection here. We also have short line railroads in Oregon. You can see some redundancy in the valley and some east-west routes. We found that the short line railroads are all extremely vulnerable. Their bridges are very old. They have almost no seismic resistance. There would be extensive damage, not only from bridges, but landslides. The short line railroads, there's a question of whether they would be economically strengthened based on the level of service they provide. We looked at our airports.
Question for
you. Okay, yes.
Could you go back to the previous slide? And you're with ODOT, right?
I'm with ODOT.
Good. So you can answer this question. In your personal mind, because you were involved in the committee, because I would not ask the railroads this, if you look at those lines right there, where is the most, at a 9.0 earthquake, which is what you used as the building in your modeling, at what point or where approximately on the east-west railroad and the north-south railroads would the new terminus be, i.e., the railroads would still be passable after a 9.0 earthquake?
Today, there's some slight chance that this line would still be operational, potentially up to Redmond, okay, which is a key point because Redmond is going to be a hub for air activities,
correct,
at least right now.
Okay.
There's a big problem right here, so I'm not sure that would work. For the coming in from Salt Lake, both the UP and the BNSF would be fine until you get to about Hood River. From there west, we've got a huge problem. So,
and you'd have to deadhead in, and mm-hmm. you'd have to reverse out.
Right now, the short-term plan is both railroad and highway through 97 to the Redmond Airport, fixed-wing aircraft from Redmond Airport to, as I'm going to explain in the next slide, five of the major state-supported airports in the valley have been selected to make resilient. So we would have feeding supplies into Redmond, Redmond to the five valley airports, and from there it would all be rotary helicopter to the west.
So you'd have to actually set up an expanded FARP at Redmond in order to do that kind of traffic?
You would. That's far less expensive right now looking at the short term.
Yeah, I understand. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And the other issue for the coastal communities, since it's only rotary to here, would be presumably the federal government would come in and anchor large supply ships off the coast, and we would have the ports get there are in very bad situation along the coast, so it would be basically beach landing craft from major shipping anchored off the coast.
Heck, we can't get ships to war in 90 days. I don't know how we're going to do that, but that's all right. I'm glad you're optimistic.
So we also looked at the Columbia River ports, and west of Portland, or east of Portland, there would be some capacity here, and those ports would actually be operational. West of Portland, it's highly likely that we would not have facilities that would be operational, including the Port of Portland. The other issue with, we took a special look at the Columbia River because of its unique nature of being able to carry large goods, and the unique situation that we've got going on here in Portland, where we have a major hub of not only highway, but rail, air, and river exchange point. The problem that we had was that the Coast Guard and CACOR reports that the dredge channel in the Columbia River has very steep slopes, and it's the river bottom is susceptible to failure and an earthquake. So there's a big problem with the dredge channel under a 9-0, and not only that, but the Astoria Bridge, the Longview Bridge, and the I-5 bridge over the Columbia would probably be down in the channel blocking shipping, at least deep draft shipping. So you'd only have the ability to do very shallow craft.
What about the opposite direction?
This would be operational, we think, east of Portland. And to the extent that you could bring in supplies from the east, there would be some ability to do that not only at Hood River but Cascade Locks.
And the Corps believes their locks will be functional?
I think to characterize that, I think that there's a really good chance that the locks would be operational. I don't think anybody would tell you that that's guaranteed. The ground motions over there are low, and there have been some studies done on the earthquake vulnerability of those.
Thank you.
Port of Portland, as I mentioned, is a very critical facility, and you can see the various terminals listed here. And not only the terminals for shipping, but the operation of the Portland International Airport. And as mentioned, the liquid fuel supplies are right here off the screen, east of the St. John's Bridge, and the pipeline over to the Portland for liquid fuel. Portland has some tanks on their own that have some storage capability, but they have the same liquefaction problem as the main private storage facilities. We did look at locals and transit, and you've seen this slide before in Kent's presentation, but we looked at it from the standpoint of if the state highways are down, are there options for either city or county roads that could provide access for damaged state highways? And there is some potential for that throughout the valley, and the report has some suggestions about how to proceed with that. This is just to give you an example of focusing in on highway now. We did a very robust vulnerability study. Highways, in fact, is probably a little bit ahead of the rest of the modes. And we were able to identify the damage to bridges and landslides, which basically cuts off the coastal communities from the valley and actually has a lot of damage within the Willamette Valley. Just to give you a view of where we're at in highway, we've been studying this actively trying to address it probably a little bit longer than the other modes, but we're still way behind. We have about 1,155 bridges that were identified that needed retrofit, and we've addressed about 355 of them in various programs, including the OTIA 3 program, which the legislature passed almost 10 years ago now, and that's made a significant difference in the ability of bridges to withstand seismic loads. We still have 800 bridges left to do, and at our current rate, it's well over 200 years before we're going to get to address those. So our key findings, highway has a pretty good inventory and an assessment, but the other modes need to have a more detailed study. We did a subjective level inventory and assessment in the resilient plan, but we need to do a more detailed study, and we need to have a gap assessment. We think that that should be managed and overseen by a statewide resilient office. We agree with other recommendations you've heard today. There is a significant interdependency issue, and we certainly recognize, we feel that highways and transportation modes are necessary for recovery and resilience, but we're also very dependent on communication and liquid fuels. We think we need to follow on with a very strategic policy and a sort of a phased report, approach, so that we can do what this state can afford to do in a timely way over a long period of time, and do it in a way that makes sense, and communicate what the plans are as they change over the decades. As we mentioned, there are some critical transportation links that we think should be some small investments made initially to allow us to at least have some limited mobility after an event. We do think we need to enhance our design and maintenance standards. Probably should be looking at a temporary bridge policy, and we could do some research. Even though we have a lot of history of retrofit and its performance, we don't know exactly the performance of in a Cascadia event, and there is some research that could be done to help that.
Madam Vice Chair has a question.
Go back to
yes.
The other. Have you set timelines to meet those projects that you feel need to be done, or do you need legislative oversight for this? Or, I mean, I'm getting nervous that we're having a lot of key findings, but boy, we need to start implementing something. You know, it could happen tomorrow, but and then it's way too late. But
yeah, I'd like to mention on the highway side, we have a phased approach and we have some timelines. And Highway Administrator Mather is going to be here shortly, and he's going to give you a presentation to clearly outline what those are for highway. On the other modes, more work is needed, and for those modes that are managed by government entities, some work could be done jointly with the legislature to come up with those. That's a need right now. For the private, that needs to be done possibly with some incentives, and maybe with the ingenuity of you all in your positions figuring out ways to do that for the private ownership.
I know. I can see you're not. It's not making money, and you know we're such a capitalistic society that, you know, it's what you can get to your shareholders or your stockholders or whoever, rather than looking at the, you know, safety and reserves and you know. So.
Yeah,
are they at the table? Is the corporations, the private sector at the table?
They were certainly at the table and willing to help with the Resilient Oregon Report, and they provided as much voluntary time as some of the rest of us. They were very clear, though, about the possibility of them investing not only in retrofit, but initially in further detailed inventories and gap analysis. They would need some incentives or some support if they were going to move forward with those. That's what we heard from the railroads. But I think what you're saying is that some legislative initiative is needed to make something happen here, and I think that you're exactly right.
Representative Boone has a question.
Yeah, I think we have, thank you, Mr. Chair. We have made some strides there, too, with some past legislation that we've passed of giving some, I think, somewhat broad authority or varied authority to the governor in the case of an emergency. But I'm wondering if we couldn't, you know, in the case of a private-public partnership, the incentives are, you know, just the sense of community for one thing, that if you're in the business that can help facilitate this, then it's kind of incumbent on you to help the effort in an emergency. But I don't know if we need, you know, or how that would that be a big, broad omnibus bill that, in this case you do this, in this case you do that, but it allows the authority, an umbrella authority, kind of like a big insurance policy.
Right, Representative. I think, Representative, if you recall, I believe, and I'm going to look out there for Dr. you or somebody else to nod their head since some of us are old here and can't remember. I think the number one issue we heard when the plan was presented from the private sector is that they need third-party liability top cover for them to do a resilience plan and then say, hey, we recognize this is a weak point right here. And as soon as they publicly say that, no disrespect, but the ambulance chasers show up to start collecting before they've even got down the road. And I think that was very clear from the private sector saying, you know, we're willing to step up to the table and at least do the planning and so on and so forth. But it's like here in the Capitol that the good chair and I, both chairs have done this time, is once you identify a risk, suddenly you've got to mitigate that risk somehow short term until you can fix it.
A little follow-up.
Please.
Maybe some of our Good Samaritan laws could cross into this. And then the other thing I was going to suggest for the things like the inventories, sounds like a great master's or dissertation thesis where you could use a little student power.
I do have one final question. Could you back up a couple of slides here? Stop right there. Go forward. In your mind, is that the number one choke point to start with right there? If you don't have liquid fuel, you don't have trucks, you don't have first responders, you don't have helicopters, you don't have fixed-wing aircraft, you don't even have trains.
No, it really is a key. And as you mentioned, I talked about an interim solution through the Redmond Airport, but all of that requires liquid fuel.
Right.
And it's been mentioned before that there is some mitigation that could be done for liquefaction for the existing tanks. I'm not sure if it's economical to retrofit or to move those, but certainly having some secondary storage in the eastern or the central part of the state makes a lot of sense. I don't know how you incentivize that, but that makes a lot of sense.
We were even told, you know, in the Senate side when we started doing this afterwards, that one of the even problems is if you get a 40,000-gallon tanker truck that it can't, you know, it can only hook its gasket or pipe up to a certain fitting at the other end. And so you could have 40,000-gallon tanks sitting at Hood River where the last bridge is, and you still can't refuel because you have no way to get it off the tanker truck into the deal. And in terms of solutions for out of the ground, the best solution I've heard so far after much stuff between our committee is four or five, you know, some sort of, you know, FARP systems that ODOT or somebody has that you, for better word, fly a helicopter into an old service station in Seaside and you steal all the fuel out of the ground after the disaster and move to the next one. So that's about the best solution I've heard. So anyway, go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Oh, thank you. And Mr. Johnson, we're getting real close. If we could wrap it up and we'll keep everybody on track.
I am. I'm finished. Thank you. I appreciate your time. And I guess the final comment that I would like to make is that just to reiterate the four things I think that we've all been saying. We need assessments, more detailed assessments. We need capital investments once we decide where the gaps are. Possibly some incentives for the private side. And it looks like we could benefit from policy changes in some areas. So thank you very much.
Absolutely, and thank you. And Representative Boone, did you have a quick question?
Yeah, just a quick one. I wanted to kind of revisit that piece of sort of satellite tanking or whatever in the same vein as what we're doing along the coast as far as having caches for food and supplies and medicines and things like that. We could have – small is not all bad. We could have small, you know, a small tank of what's compressed natural gas or something like that, or small – tanks of fuel, even biofuels or whatever you need in these areas, and they can be in different places so that, as Senator Boquist just said, you know, I liked his visual of popping down in a helicopter and sucking out all the gas out of these little stations, because people won't be able to get to them in that sense. So anyway, we could go on that. That's another day.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Any further questions, Mr. Johnson? Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. And this is one of a series of three of these joint meetings that we'll be discussing these things. And next up, I think we have Ms. Coho from the Administrator of Safety, Reliability and Security, PUC. How are you today?
Very good. Thank you.
Good. Well, welcome to the committee. And, of course, you'll have to state your name for the record. And
good afternoon, Chairs Boquist and Matthews and the rest of the committee. My name is Lori Coho, and I'm the Administrator of the Safety, Reliability, and Security Division at the Public Utility Commission. Tell you a little bit about the role that the safety group has at the commission. One of the big things is that we enforce the National Electric Safety Code for all electric and telecommunication utilities. That's the National Electric Safety Code only. It's a limited thing. We don't have broad regulations over the municipalities, the PUDs, and the co-ops. So just on the safety code. We have started looking at the seismic preparedness of our investor-owned utilities. We've had a few workshops. I'll talk about that in a second. We set and enforce service quality standards for the investor-owned utilities, and we also ensure that pipeline, power lines, transformer stations, and energy facilities operate safely. I want to say that on the pipeline safety, that's natural gas pipelines only. We do that through Department of Transportation, PHMSA. That we get a grant from them. We are sometimes deputized to look at interstate utilities, interstate gas pipelines, and we have been deputized on occasion to look at some work that's happened on those. But we are really looking at the within-state pipelines, so that would be Cascade Natural Gas, Northwest Natural Gas, and Avista Utilities. We also are there, and we're part of the emergency response for ESF 2 and 12. 2 is communication, 12 is energy, and that would be with the Oregon Department of Energy. And we're a member of the emergency response system, the interagency hazard mitigation team, the governor's recovery cabinet, and the energy emergency management team. We did participate in the development of the recommendations, knowing that our authority, however, is limited to the utilities that fall under our jurisdiction. Now, that's about 70% of the customers within the state who are customers of Idaho Power, Pacific Power, and Portland General Electric. We have set expectations with utilities that they are performing seismic assessments and that they undertake prudent investments in infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I think in the energy section of the report, there was an example of how Northwest Natural actually came in with a tariff to do some upgrades of some pipelines specifically for seismic preparedness. So when a utility has identified a specific weakness, we do have mechanisms that allow them to go and address those. We will continue to work with the regulated utilities to achieve the goals in the reports. Again, we've had two workshops with the utilities, and we continue to review their plans. We also have participate in regional organizations, certainly the Western Electric Coordinating Council, look at what's happening in the region and any place that we can provide some input or places that we can influence. So during our emergency workshops, our emergency preparedness workshops, we deliberated a bit of whether we wanted those to be totally open workshops or whether we wanted to adjourn and go into executive session with the commissioners. And a lot of that discussion was because of this liability issue. If the utilities were to come forward and state what their vulnerabilities were, then they're liable on those. We chose to leave those meetings open. We chose to have the utilities participating together, so hopefully they could learn as much from each other as possible. Again, we want to have them identifying their seismic vulnerabilities and then finding ways to bring those to us so we can help them get the rate recovery to mitigate those prudent investments. Again, those are prudent investments. And prudent is a question that is relative to different people depending on what they believe the risk is. And so sometimes we need help in with the public or even with the legislature in helping define what the appetite is for the risk, what is the risk. I think consistent with what you've heard today, earlier, some of the things that we heard were that the utilities can respond, or the responses and the recovery time that they stated in the report were dependent on all the other infrastructure. And so they need transportation infrastructure if they're going to get out and respond to these outages. They can't get there, they can't do anything. They certainly need available liquid fuel. Again, liquid fuel is not under the purview of the PUC. We are looking at natural gas pipelines only.
Question for you.
Yes.
Obviously, you're the PUC, so you must know the answer. Is there anybody in charge of the liquid fuel in Oregon?
I should know that answer, and I thought I should ask that, and I would ask Department of Energy.
Okay, great.
We'll have a chance. Okay. Yeah, Deanna Henry's here, so thank you.
Deanna Henry. Energy knows that. So again, contingencies that are necessary for response are identified, the liability issue, and then certainly the permitting processes. And so what was, you know, brought up about permitting for locations of lines, permitting for vehicles that are coming in. I might also add that we've heard issues about, we do a great job of waiving permitting for vehicles coming in, but we don't ever give people a way to get back home when they come in to help us out. And so, you know, the permitting is a two-way street in the issue of an emergency. So that's just kind of a quick overview. Yes, we've been participating. Yes, we've been working with the utilities, and not sure what else I can answer for you.
I appreciate that, and the quick overview is much appreciated, because that's what we had given you time to prepare. So I really appreciate that, and thank you. Any questions, Ms. Coho? Seeing none, really appreciate it. And your contact information is also on the slide, and it's part of the OLIS website. So thank you so much. Really appreciate your time today. And coming up behind you now to answer a question and to present her side from Department of Energy, Deanna Henry.
Yes.
Ms. Henry, welcome to the committee.
Chair Matthews and Chair Boquist and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about the liquid fuels section of our responsibility. We do share responsibilities on preparing for energy emergencies with the PUC, and we do take the lead on the petroleum sector. And, you know, even under normal circumstances,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we just need your name for the record, and you have to identify yourself.
I'm Deanna Henry, and I'm the Emergency Preparedness Manager for the Oregon Department of Energy.
Thank you so much.
Okay. So even under normal circumstances, Oregon does face some unique challenges when it comes to a long-term or severe petroleum emergency. So the problem with Oregon is that we are very vulnerable. We do not have any refining capacity, nor do we have any crude oil reserves in state. So we import 100% of our fuel, and 90%, the bulk of it, comes from four refineries in the Puget Sound area of Washington State. And we rely on one 230-mile pipeline to get 75% of that fuel to Oregon, and the remaining 25% come by tanker vessels. And then we do only receive a very small amount, less than 10%, from refineries in California and Utah. So San Francisco refinery pipes fuel to Chico, California, to a terminal there where it's trucked into servicing southern Oregon communities. And then the Pasco, Washington terminal receives fuel from Salt Lake City refinery into Eastern Oregon. So the bulk of our fuel, and you've heard, does come from refineries in Washington State. All of that fuel enters into the fuel hub, whether by pipeline or tanker vessel. And then from those terminals, two pipelines, one to the airport and one down to Kinder Morgan's terminal in Eugene, Oregon. Also barge service along the Columbia River to Eastern Oregon. And then a fleet of about 1,500 tanker trucks disseminate fuel throughout Oregon's 2,250 retail service stations. So while the system's pretty stable in our region, we have an extremely tight system. So by that I mean Washington State's refineries have been operating at near capacity for nearly 20 years, so there is no ability to produce additional product should we need it for whatever reason. And at the Portland terminal, we have about 7 to 10 day reserve on hand at any given time. And at the local level, at our service stations, we have about 2 to 3 day supply on hand. And there's no flexibility in the system. And to give you perspective, if every motorist in Oregon were to put 2 additional gallons of fuel in their cars today, we would have created our own temporary shortage. And this is under normal circumstances. So preparing for disruptions has been a priority of ours for a long time. We have the Oregon Petroleum Contingency Plan. And in that plan, it does authorize us to require that the suppliers in Oregon set aside a certain amount of fuel for our use should we have a long-term or severe disruption of any kind. And we wouldn't allocate fuel unless there was a widespread event where our emergency services and essential services were not able to get fuel at any cost. Here is our set-aside percentages. This is what we can require the petroleum terminals to set aside for our use should we have that necessity to do. We would decide what the set-aside volume is and work with our suppliers and wholesalers to implement that plan, and we would tell them how much fuel we need and where it should go. Once we decide what the set-aside volume is, and that is based on national guidelines on setting percentages so that we minimally impact the market and we don't drive the price, so all the fuel that is delivered through the set-aside program would be by market price. Once a set-aside has been established, we would work with our priority users to assess their needs and to get that fuel to them. And we do have a three-tiered approach on how we allocate fuel to our emergency and essential services. Tier one is law enforcement, fire, and medical services. Tier two is our essential services sector, all the folks that you've been hearing from today. In any given emergency, there are 13 pre-identified critical lifelines and services that, should they be disrupted, could impact public health and safety, as well as our economy and our national security. So these are our primary customers, and we recognize that. And just so you know, our planning efforts with every one of these emergency support functions, there we have a federal lead agency that we coordinate with. And for us, it's the U.S. Department of Energy, and we are on conference calls with them on a quarterly basis with 15 other states so that we could collaborate and coordinate our responses, because this will be a regional event, because we do rely on Washington's fuel. And then we have a last tier. Communities can also request fuel from our set-aside program when they can demonstrate that they are facing a hardship based on a shortage in fuel. Delivering fuel and allocating fuel becomes very difficult post-earthquake, and we recognize that, and we've been working on those kinds of things because the petroleum sector itself requires electricity to do damage assessments, and we know by working with the refineries and the terminals that it will take them at least 48 hours once power is available for them to do an engineering assessment, and that's just assessing their damages. It's not restarting their facilities. We'll also need communication, because we're going to need the ability to talk to the folks who have the fuel and the folks who will need the fuel from us. And of course, to move fuel, we need roads, bridges, and a waterway that's clear of debris. So as we're working the interdependencies from in-state, this is an event that's going to require us to have federal assistance. So the fuel that everybody wants to know where it's going to come from, it will have to come from outside of our area. And our contact will be the U.S. Department of Energy, and they understand that. You know, a while back we talked with them about possibly having reserves of fuel somewhere in Oregon or Washington so that we could share these resources. And you know what? They have worked that problem and tried to work that issue, and so far they haven't come up with an answer for us. So we're going to also have to work with the Environmental Protection Agency, because we do realize that there will be islands and pockets of fuel that might survive a quake, and we're going to need to lift some of the environmental requirements so that we can move and get to that fuel. We're also working with the Federal Motor Carriers Association to ensure that we can lift driver hours so that we can get fuel deliveries into Oregon, because fuel is going to have to come from longer distances. And so we're working with the federal family to kind of, they understand our operating picture, they understand where Washington's at, they understand that they're going to need to be working with both our states to recover from a catastrophic earthquake. And we're also going to need military support as well. The fuel that's going to be coming in from outside of our region, we're going to assume that our fuel hub is going to be down. So what we've learned from the National Guard is they have compiled this list of resources and capabilities that they can provide us during after an earthquake. And what we're going to need from them are mobile tank farms. And they can be able to set that up for us, put them wherever we tell them to put it, so that they could receive the fuel that comes from the U.S. Department of Energy. We'll need distribution points for our industry folks, because what we've learned is military does not have capabilities to assist us in restoring transmission or generation, but they can help us with distribution. So if we can find them a landing strip or a major distribution point, they will be bringing their aircraft, their specialized personnel, and their folks to restore their facilities and systems. And of course, we're going to need power and generators, and that can come from the Guard, or it can come from other resources, but we're going to need power at those terminals. And also, the Guard will have also capabilities to assist ODOT or whoever else to build roads to support our fuel deliveries as well. And we're working with the Coast Guard to find ways to, they have a very robust program to remove river debris, but what we're asking them to help us with is to identify docks, alternate docks, because we're likely going to lose the three that we have. They're just not built to code. So if they can identify alternate docks for us to receive vessels, that would be very helpful to our recovery. Also, we need barges. In the extended lock outage that we just recently had with the U.S. Corps of Engineers, we just learned that there are not available barges just sitting around waiting for us to transport fuel. They're usually on the move. So we're working with the Coast Guard to consider modifying grain barges to transport fuel during this emergency time frame. So we're working a lot of the issues, because it is our job to be able to respond if there are no improvements done to the system and this emergency happens tomorrow. So those are the things we're looking at. And a last area of planning that I just want to mention to the committee is the role of biofuels. Do we have enough biodiesel and ethanol to supplement our emergency response efforts post-earthquake? We're looking for that fuel to be fueling emergency vehicles, as well as fueling generators at critical facilities like 911 centers, as well as hospitals. We realize that biofuels cannot replace conventional oil, but what we're hoping it will do is buy us some time, reduce consumption on oil so that industry will have the time to make the repairs it needs so that we can recover the system quickly. And that kind of, in a nutshell, is what we've been doing on the petroleum sector and petroleum front to prepare for that catastrophic event. Are there any questions for me?
Anybody have any questions for Ms. Henry? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our nation has a strategic oil reserve, which I think you referenced. And you mentioned that they have not decided the appropriateness or whatever for the location of a fuel reserves here in the Pacific Northwest. I'm assuming they means the federal government?
They are the federal government, Representative Wade.
Mr. Chairman, may I proceed? So,
absolutely.
Thank you. So, what would be the state's assessment of our need for a state strategic fuels reserve?
We completely supported their movement in that direction. I think the problems that they ran into was didn't quite know how to pick the right location. The locations that they were picking were very close to the liquefaction zone. And then it got very political. Who would pay for it? How would we sustain it? What incentive do we give industry to maintain it? How do we move fuel in and out of it? It just, in their minds, got too political.
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect here, I think in most measures, population and anything else you want to consider, Oregon amounts to about 3 or 4% of just about anything in our country. Mm-hmm. And I think that we'll get about 3 or 4% of the federal government's consideration when the time comes due. And I think that we need to be assessing our own reserve needs. And I would just say, without being conspiratorial, these are the same folks that have hoarded all of our nation's ammunition as well. I would hate to see, come emergency time, how much fuel we get at 3 or 4%. So,
Thank you, Representative. Duly noted.
Just a brief comment, Mr. Chair. And,
yes.
And I appreciate the work that the Department of Energy is doing. I think you've correctly pointed out that we have planning to go. I'm not as optimistic, or I guess I'm just as optimistic as my colleague down there, that the military is going to roll in and save us somewhere about day 30. And so I just hope when you're doing your planning over there that you recall, as you pointed out and recognized yourself and seeing the deal here, is there will be no terminal, there'll be no power, there'll be no roads, there'll be no market, there'll be no communications, and there'll be no Federalists. So therefore, wherever that end of the road is, we got to have fuel there for ODOT contractors and everybody else to build the first bridge, extend the first power line, set up the first cell tower, and do it all over again until we get to the coast. And unfortunately, Representative Witt, it might be a while before we get there. But we got to figure out how to do it by our own bootstraps, not the feds. Thank you.
And thank you again for your time today. Really appreciate it, Ms. Henry. Have a great day. And with that, we will invite Mr. Mather, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. State Bridge Engineer. And is Bruce Johnson going to join you as well, or are you going to fly solo? Mr. Johnson, welcome again. And you'll need to restate your name for the record. And we are dealing with kind of the original timeline that you were given. We're going to try to keep it to about 10 minutes, if you could, please.
Yeah, I'm done. Hey, Mr. Chair, they've been here and given us doom and gloom before, so we're familiar with this.
Yes, sir.
Chair Matthews, Chair Boquist, members of the committees, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. As Bruce Johnson, our state bridge engineer, has already talked to you about the larger transportation question and kind of where we are in the different modes. As he said several times, highway has been further ahead in its development of a response plan to a major earthquake. And what I'm going to walk through today is just kind of where we are in our development of that response plan. As Bruce talked about, there's really two things we're worried about from a highway standpoint. There's our bridges and there's landslides. And so we do retrofit to our bridges and mitigation to landslides to prepare for this large event. One of the first things we did was identify strategic lifeline routes. Obviously, we can't deal with all the state highway system all at once, so we have to be strategic in how we approach that. And the other new piece in watching some of the other major events around the world is the impact long-term to our economy. So not just the loss of life to begin with, the response to the event, but also long-term, how do we keep business functioning, growing in the state as we recover from this. So those are the three things that we look at in putting this together: survivability, life support, and again, the economic recovery aspect. As we look at, and there's a much longer presentation, but just trying to be brief here, this is our recommended lifeline routes that we have across the state. And again, we can't address every route, but this is how we basically triage the system. And there's a number of factors, obviously, that go into this. The population centers, hospitals, as well as just the highway itself, how many bridges, how many landslides do they have, what's the cost benefit of doing this route versus another route. So many of those factors we kind of put all together and came out with these as the recommended routes. So as we kind of break those down, the first tier of those, the first priority, we actually split that in half, trying to get down to something we can start with, kind of a bite-sized piece to work with. $900 million to deal with the seismic retrofit of bridges and the landslide issues on this set of routes that are depicted here. We split it in half, which roughly splits that $900 million in half. Again, as Bruce pointed out in his presentation, starting from kind of solid ground on the east and then moving further towards the where we expect the destruction to be, and really securing kind of that beachhead on Highway 97, finding ways to move further to the west as we kind of stage for recovery. Stages are tiers 2 and 3. Again, total about another $900 million to deal with seismic and landslide issues, and those are the set of routes that are there. The other piece that we've added on to this is that economic recovery piece. So these are the routes we put in place to deal with the immediate loss of life, immediate impacts, and then that short-term recovery, but long-term, years that we expect to as we deal with the devastation from this. Our economic models is the same model we use to As we developed the OTIA 3 bridge program, some of you may be remembering that from about 10 years ago, where we predicted and developed a strategic response to our bridge. We applied that same kind of thinking and the same model to this. And as we look over that 8 to 10-year period of recovery, that model predicts about a $350 billion loss in Oregon's economy. So how can we mitigate that? Here, in that strategy that I just talked about in those in the routes, here is the total impact of that $300 billion and where that would be in the state. So when you look at this map, think of a heat map. And so the darker the color, the longer the impact is going to be of those. The longest color on here would be a five-year impact where these areas or these highways would not have access for up to 5 years as Chair Boquist talked about, kind of went down the end of that road trying to recover through this response. And so look at the map, the zones, some of those zones are isolated and then some particular highways are also isolated. So it's a kind of a combination of both. If you look in the Willamette Valley, for example, it's largely white, but you'll see some red roads in there. Those red roads are going to be some time to get back, but there's other bypasses in the Willamette Valley. When you get out in the rural areas, you don't have those bypasses, so you have whole blocks of land that are going to be isolated. So as we move forward, if we do that, the stage one that I talked about, we're going to reduce that overall economic impact by about 10% or $35 billion. Moving ahead to the full implementation, we think it's about $84 billion that we'd be able to take off of that $350 billion, or roughly 20-25% we think we can take off. And you can see the color just by visually looking at that map. It gets much, much lighter in the overall impact to it. As you summarize those things, the total cost that it would take to do all three of those tiers that I just described, $1.8 billion, the overall savings or reduction in impact to the economy, $84 billion, or a cost-benefit ratio of 46 to 1. So roughly, for every dollar you spend, you're roughly saving about $50 to the economy going forward. So I think that's helpful for us to frame up a response to this and what's in it for the economy of Oregon, and why are we making this investment? It helps kind of frame that response. As we look to our neighbors to the north and the south, we're behind, as you've heard about in some of the other presentations. California obviously experiences a lot more earthquakes than we do, and they've been much more proactive in the response because of the reminder they get much more often than we do about the vulnerability of earthquakes. Washington is also ahead of us. Our message here is really, it is kind of doom and gloom, but it's not that we've got to go out and solve this problem tomorrow. It's really a message of we've got to start. What I'm reminded here of is the old fable of the tortoise and the hare. We don't have to be the hare trying to run out and win this race, but we've got to start the race, and we've got to continue just methodically working down to respond to this. So as we look at this and kind of sum this up, to avoid the $84 billion in loss, we just need to have some dedicated resources to start addressing these routes, start addressing the bridges, and start addressing the landslides so we can start preparing ourselves over a long period of time for the event that eventually someday we'll be here. So just a quick summary, trying to move through that quickly, Mr. Chair.
And I appreciate that. Yes. Any questions for Mr. Miller? Yes.
The last slide that you were just on, it had Oregon, Washington, California, and the dollar amounts. Are those dollars that have already been invested, or are those dollars that need to be invested? The slide's not
quite clear. Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, those are in dollars that have invested to date.
Okay. So can I follow up?
Yes.
So when you say we're behind, and what quantifies behind? I mean, 143 bridges, $44 million, 416 bridges, 177. I'm trying to get a sense of what makes us behind.
Yeah, I apologize for just trying to be brief on this slide and maybe leaving some of those things out. Obviously, the number of bridges and your vulnerability, there's a lot of other factors, but just trying to demonstrate here the amount of investment each of those states have made. We're behind in those investments. But if you look at the comprehensive plans that California has made, if you look at the planning that Washington has made and where they are in progressing in those plans, we're way behind there. Those states, in relative terms to the amount of planning they've done and implementation of those plans that they've done.
Question here. Yes. So does the legislature have to get the whip out and say, do it, or can you, within your own agency, start implementing these?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miles Anderson, our proposal is to have this conversation as we have a funding package conversation in future sessions to make this a component of that. If we were to take it out of the existing gas tax revenue, there would be consequences to other parts of our economy, other parts of our highway network. Obviously, you could do that and reprioritize things, but there's downsides to that. As we've talked to our Transportation Commission about those trade-offs, they're very concerned about this, but have made it a priority for them as we get additional opportunities at the federal level to apply money here or additional revenue at the state level to apply here. One of the things that we've just done recently is applied for a federal Tiger Grant money to start implementing some of the proposals that we have here. So you'll see those when those opportunities present themselves at the state level, the federal level, we'll be looking for money to make investments on this plan. I think the key part for us is we now have a plan, we have direction of where we want to go. Relative to some of the other modes, they haven't done this next stage of planning to really kind of tee up that next implementation stage of this as to what resources are needed, what are the benefits that are going to be, where do you start in those investments. This plan outlines all those, at least for the highway network, but not for rail, not for, you know, airports and others. They really need to do that planning next.
Just a brief comment, Mr. Chairman. I don't do this often, as the director says. You know, ODOT's done a fairly remarkable job from 2005 to now in prioritizing and getting out ahead on the emergency preparedness and the tsunami issues and so on and so forth. And I think that's a good thing. They've done a fairly remarkable job. Unfortunately, we've done 143 bridges, as was pointed out, but I think we have 1,000 or some or so left on the slides that are out there. And it's an issue we need to figure out how to address, because other than that, we're going to be starting beyond Hood River and moving to the west. And again, I'd like to thank the Department of Energy for their work, too. Though, I think, you know, we need to get up and move faster.
And I am glad that you have the Sandy Bridge, which is on the border of my district and Senator Chuck Thompson's bridge. I've been glad you chose that as one of your first ones.
He owns it now. Well, if he owns it, he can repair it. No, I'm just kidding. Well, thank you. Any other questions for the panel? Just want to thank everybody and let you know again, this was one of a three-part series of joint meetings that we'll be holding. We'll also hear from the private-public partnership end of this thing. We'll hear from the agencies of, I think, DEQ and the emergency management, as well as the Oregon Health Authority. So there's just a lot of information that's going to be flying as a result of that. And that doesn't mean that it's done. That just means that we're having a greater discussion than what we can allow in any one committee. So I appreciate your participation today and understanding the tight restriction of time. And apologize, we got just a few minutes behind, but we had a late floor on both sides and lots of meetings in the building. So with that, if there are no further questions, I will close the informational meeting on earthquake and tsunami preparedness.
And the Senate will do likewise. Thank you.
And we will then adjourn the House Committee on Veterans Services and Emergency Preparedness.
And the Senate Committee.